Hey everybody, Melissa McKenzie, publisher of The American Spectator, joined today with a different co-host because my usual co-host, senior editor Scott McKay, is out with COVID. And so we are bringing in our new star, Nate Hockman, and a writer here at The American Spectator now to take poor Scott's place. How are you doing today, Nate?
Doing great. I've got big shoes to fill, obviously, but hopefully I don't let any of the listeners down.
Well, I think you're at least as radical as Scott, so everybody else should feel really, really comfortable having you around today. What I wanted to talk to you about is you have a piece up at the American Spectator talking about immigration and illegal immigration. One of the things you brought up in your piece that I thought was particularly interesting and important, and something that's so every once in a while, somebody writes something that's so obvious, and then, but it's not something that you've actually consciously thought about. And that is that in every wave of immigration that we've had, whether it be the Irish or the Italian, and the Italians at one point, I made fun of my ex's family because they're Italian and called them WAPs because that meant without papers.
Oh,
So this
yeah.
is not a new thing in America, being without papers, but the Italians kind of came in. And you talk in your piece about the flavor of America changing based on the different waves of immigration that we had, whether it was, the Scottish, the Germans, the, we have places here in Texas that are like all German towns. All the pronunciations, the food that you get there is German, which people think, oh, and we have waves. People don't realize that Mexicans were the first people in Texas and fought on the side of Texas against Santa Anna, against the government there that was overreaching and the people here. So a lot of the Mexicans here are original settlers who fought for freedom and independence. And so it's a different flavor here among the Mexican people, the multi-generations. So we have all of these different kind of constituencies here, and it's true across the country. And we're not really considering that with all the illegal immigration right now. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, well, I think some people are considering it. I mean, it's a topic that is increasingly unavoidable just given the sheer numbers coming across our border right now. Those of us in the Beltway are lucky to be mostly insulated from the effects of immigration. But if you told someone on a border town that, a lot of people coming across your border changes your community, and the kinds of people coming across your border changes your community, that would strike them as so obvious that you didn't even need to say it out loud. But to a certain extent, your country is your people. I mean, there are other things about a country that make it what it is. But just as a basic thought experiment, if you took America and put it, in an empty continent, you took all of the Americans, 300, 350 million or whatever, and sent them to Antarctica. Antarctica, it wouldn't be America, but it would be something resembling America. If you
Right.
took the population of China, for example, and put them in North America, it would not be America anymore. It would be a different country, right? So there are other things, obviously, that makes a country, your constitutional system, your landscape, your buildings, and all of those things have been integral to what America was and continues to be. But the basic point that I was making is that the character of the people in your country matter. And so when you've got a lot of new people coming into your country, their character matters. And I was using Haiti as a sort of specific example, and we can get into that. But the point I was making that you alluded to earlier was that every successive wave of immigration to America has fundamentally changed America. When Irish people came to America, America is a different country today than it would be if a lot of Irish people hadn't come. They brought something from the old country with them, and that became part of America. The same is true of Italian people, like you said. The same is true of Polish people, Mexicans, et cetera, Germans. I mentioned offhandedly in the piece, the founders were really concerned about German immigration, which seems kind of antiquated now. But they were worried that Germans didn't share the sort of Anglo love of liberty.
That was a rational fear, by the way.
It absolutely was. It absolutely was. And the point is, like, all of these waves of different people bring the old country with them. And what I was arguing in the piece is that's the double-edged sword of assimilation. The people who come here become more like their adopted home, but their adopted home also becomes more like them. So when you're looking at immigration today, it would be extremely naive to not consider the character of the places that people are coming from, because immigrants from different places are going to affect your country differently at scale, which is not to say that immigrants from on an individual basis from any one particular place shouldn't be let in on an individual basis, but we're talking about something in, you know, the millions and millions of people on that scale. We're talking about the generalized impact of people from a particular place at scale. And it is absolutely rational for anyone who cares about the country and its future to consider the fact that immigrants from certain places are going to impact the country differently than immigrants from other places. And some will have a better impact and some will have a worse impact.
Well, I'm thinking about a couple places. So in Cuba, you have a lot of Cuban immigrants into Miami who are really understand the limits of communism. In contrast, you have a lot of Mexican immigrants into California, which is different than the Mexican. I know this sounds crazy, people. It's distinctly different than the immigrants into Texas. And part of it is they're motivated by different things. And so they go to different places. La Raza does not exist in the same way in Texas as it does in Southern California. There's a lot more integration in Texas than there is in California, because part in the rules of Texas, you have to learn English by second grade. You have to. It's integrated after that point, and the kids are all in English. That's not the case in some other states. So you'll have children who go through their schooling in this bilingual program, never fully assimilating and acculturating just by the language. And language is such a big part of acculturation. And so you create these subgroups who never fully integrate, which is actually a huge disadvantage when every single Chinese kid is learning English, because it's the, you know, lingua franca of the world now. And in order to participate in society, knowing English is just the language of business around the world. And so then you have pockets in these liberal places where in America, they're not even teaching it in the same way. And so then it becomes a question of what is our culture? And do we have a cohesive one now? Because the melting pot that of this notion in the 50s and 60s is a completely different idea than this DEI world that we have. So what does it even mean to be American right now? And this this notion of cultural appropriation is laughable. You know, I say that as a Scottish person, you know, of Scottish descent, Scottish English. Everybody wears kilts and, you know, or plaid. And I don't sit there every time I see some black guy wearing plaid go, oh, you know, he's culturally appropriating. That looks like Michael Ansartin, you know. No, I mean, that's assimilation. We all become one. And when my daughter was little, I put her hair in dreads because it was just easy while she was swimming all the time. Was that cultural appropriation? Well, maybe, but it worked. And that's just America. But there seems to be a, you know, what is America now? And I don't even know if there's a central defining thing anymore. Would you, you know, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's certainly a major concern. And I think part of it is what you were saying, which is the question of what is American culture. In the context of immigration particularly, it also is a question of, do we have the self-confidence anymore to insist that new arrivals assimilate into a concrete American culture? And that gets to what you're talking about bilingual education, DEI, all of these new fads. One of the major problems that isn't talked about enough in terms of assimilation is not just people not learning the language, et cetera, although that's a big deal as well, but the fact that they send their kids off to college. This is supposed to be the American dream, right? The immigrant gets here, they work really hard. They, you know, demonstrate integrity. They make it up to the middle class and their kids goes to college. The problem is when their kid goes to college now, they get taught that this country hates them and that they should reject it. That's the problem. The college is actually teaching young children of immigrants to alienate themselves and to be anti-assimilationists, not just not assimilate, but to be actively opposed to the concept of assimilation, which is considered racist, bigoted, et cetera, now on college campuses. And you see that in the fact that, you know, we talk a lot about immigrants having, well, this is something conservatives used to talk about a lot about is, you know, these immigrants coming over the border, they've got conservative values, they're Christian, they're pro-family, they're pro-life, et cetera. To a certain extent, that might be true of the first generation of immigrants when they get here. But their kids, because they attain the old American dream and send their kids to college, become super left-wing. And that's reflected in the polling as well, because they go to college. And that is our fault, really. I mean, on one level, because we have lost the confidence to enforce and insist that if you come here, you know, you can be welcome, but you have to assimilate into our culture rather than actively rejecting it. And I think, you know, you use the famous terminology of a melting pot. And on one sense, I get why people use that phrase for a long time in America. But on the other hand, like a melting pot, if the idea is you just throw anything into a melting pot, it becomes something that isn't anything at all. And I think some of the sort of cultural incoherence about what is America, what is American identity today, is because of that long-standing mythology of a melting pot. It is true that in America, because of our history, we do have an enormous amount of cultural vibrance and dynamism, et cetera. But it used to be that assimilation meant something more than just the melting pot. It meant the expectation that if you came here, there was already a concrete culture here in America. There were a belief system. There was a set of cultural assumptions, of practices, of things you did, of things you didn't do, et cetera. And if you wanted to be a good American, and our expectation was that you needed to be a good American if you came here, you were expected to assimilate into something concrete. It wasn't just an inchoate melting pot. It was actually a real American culture that existed and had norms and ideas and beliefs and practices and behavior sets that immigrants were expected to abide by. So I think, you know, the melting pot is preferable to what we have now, which is actually anti-assimilation, which is actually encouraging immigrants, particularly younger immigrants when they get to college, to reject America. But I think the melting pot itself is part of the problem that got us here. And we actually need to go back to something that predates the melting pot, which is a much more concrete sense of who we are and who we expect that you will be if you come here.
Okay, so the thing that pops into my head while you're saying this is money. Because part of the reasons why college campuses have turned into the morass that they have is because they're getting funding from Saudi benefactors or Chinese benefactors and research departments and are put in place and huge grants from foreign countries. And that leads the college leadership to not want to tick off these various wealthy nations who are actually funding the destruction of what it means to be America, because they're like, well, and some of the evidence for that is the Hamas protests all over these campuses where there's this kind of idea, well, we can't say anything. And so much of the funding comes for these kids. Maybe they're foreign students. Maybe their parents are sending them and paying full weight, you know, at these various state schools. I know that in California in particular, and a lot of the Ivies, they can charge, they actually prefer foreign students because they pay the full amount of money, and the administrative kind of state of these colleges is so top heavy that in order to keep these fat cats in the manner they're accustomed to, instead of just educating, they have all these layers. They need that money. It's not enough to have in-state tuition by actual citizens being paid. They have to have this foreign money in order to survive. And because of demographics coming up, losing students, which is something that's happening, not just there's attrition because young men in particular are going, forget this, I'm not going to college. But also demographically, there's a drop off. They have to rely more on foreign students and foreign donors to support American students in the form of these kind of departments that are actually funding, anti-American places of propaganda. And so, what do you do about that?
So foreign funding of anything in America, or at least reliance on foreign funding, of anything, is a big problem, as is the sort of system that we have in terms of foreign students in general. But the bulk of university funding in America comes from Americans and often comes from the American government. And university campuses, particularly our elite university campuses in America, have been extremely left-wing since at least the 1960s. Really, they've been left-wing since prior to the 1960s. I mean, the book that launched the conservative movement was William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale, which was written in the 50s. And he was complaining back then about liberal university professors. Now, reading it now, I reread it recently, and it's a trip down memory lane. Just looking at what was considered liberal in the
Right.
50s, right? I mean, the things that Buckley was complaining about back then, I would kill to have had that kind of liberalism on my college campus. But progressivism as a movement in many ways was born in the academy. And really, since the 1960s, has underwent, first of all, progressivism itself has become much more radical, particularly in the cultural sphere. And it facilitated a hostile takeover in the 1960s, and then subsequently consolidated power in the subsequent decades. So, I don't know as much about the specific issue of what foreign governments are funding in American universities. I'm totally open to the idea that it's a big problem. I mean, it sounds on its face like a big problem, but I think the fundamental problem is right here in America. And it's the fact that the American universities, operated by Americans mostly, have been extremely left-wing for a long time. And the federal government has also been actively encouraging them to be left-wing, even under Republican presidents. The Department of Education bureaucrats are often extremely left-wing. The entire civil rights regime has facilitated a lot of extremely left-wing activities. With government funding through attaching strings to things, through different regulations, requirements, et cetera. There's been certain ebbs and flows from, the Obama administration to Trump administration reforms to back to the Biden administration. But the consistent trend line has been going in one direction. And these are, especially the elite universities, these are the institutions that educate the next generation of elites. The Ivy Leagues, one of the reasons that the fights over the Ivy Leagues are so important right now is because the Ivy Leagues are where the future Supreme Court justices and bankers and lawyers and politicians and NGO nonprofit leaders, et cetera, et cetera. That's where they're going to come from. And if you look at the condition of the kids that are graduating from those universities today, it's not a pretty picture. It's actually extremely disturbing. So I think, absolutely, let's have a conversation about confronting foreign funding, no question. But I think that, you cut all the foreign funding tomorrow, the universities are still going to be way too left-wing. And that's a problem that we have to solve here in America, ultimately.
So do you think quotas? You
What
know,
kind of
like ideological quotas that for every lib prof that you hire, you have to hire a conservative one.
That's a good question. I think, what DeSantis tried to do in Florida in terms of some of his reforms, widely criticized, including by some sort of free speech groups on the libertarian right. I think that's basically the right approach. Like, we ha conservatives f have been fighting a very noble, honorable fight for decades to try to reform universities from within. You set up the conservative groups, you've got all these very well-funded nonprofits that send conservative speakers to campus, et cetera, et cetera. And it's great, for me as a young conservative student, I certainly benefited from it, but it does not solve the problem comprehensively. And I think what conservatives have realized in the education fights over the last few years, especially, is that the only real solution, especially when it comes to public education, is going to come from government policy. because government is often the only actual lever of power that we control in a lot of these places. We don't control universities, and the left wingers who control universities are not interested in conservatives actually making meaningful reforms. So yeah, I think having some sort of ideological quotas on the table is absolutely something that should be talked about. Because I think that if we don't demand that universities make space for conservatives, and often the only way you do that is through either government regulation or conditioning government funds of universities based on the reforms, if we don't make those demands, they're not going to happen. So I think ideological reforms or ideologically oriented reforms, including requiring professors from across the ideological spectrum, it's one of a suite of solutions, but it actually absolutely, I think, is going to be part of the solution.
Okay, so back to illegal immigration. One of the interesting things in your piece about talks about Haiti and how their neighbors over the mountains erected a wall and expelled 187,000. I always think of Haitians because of, have you ever seen the movie Clueless?
I have not, no.
Oh my goodness, you have to watch it. But anyway, it's a great movie, but she has a whole speech in there about Haiti because this, and this was in the 80s because they were having problems in the 80s because they've, as you know, 200 years of problems in Haiti. And she talks about letting them come in. We've got room. Anyway, it's a very, but she calls them the Haitians. So like we know a wall works because it worked there. We don't have one here, but we have a lot of Haitians coming across the border. We have a lot of Chinese coming across the border. We have a lot of people who are very, you know, I think the dominant religion in Haiti is voodoo. So we're importing black magic into America. We're importing communists into America, all of them fighting age, by the way. Not even giving a thought about what we're doing to the nature of our country. Now, some people say, Melissa, that's racist. When I say, shut the border and let's identify everybody and expel those who are not actively adding are a positive addition to our country and expel the rest. How do you answer the charge that you're just a racist, Nate Hochman?
Well, to
And
a certain extent, that's a charge that's going to be leveled regardless of what you say if you're, right of Bernie Sanders. But no, what would be racist would be to say we are never going to let another Haitian into the country again because they're Haitian. What would be rational and sane and is necessary for a sane immigration policy is to recognize, and I was just using Haiti as an example because the country has totally collapsed and nature of the collapse is particularly striking in just how barbaric and awful it is. And on a humanitarian level, our hearts should go out to the people of Haiti who are suffering. But the humanitarian concern does not, humanitarianism is not a suicide pact. It does not obligate us to ruin our country because people in other parts of the world are suffering, even if they're suffering very significantly. So the basic rational point that I'm making, which I haven't actually heard a refutation of at any point in any juncture in the immigration policy, is that people from different countries en masse at scale have a different impact on America when they come here, and that Haiti is not a good country, which is not to say that every Haitian is bad or that every Haitian can't come here or that every Haitian can't become a good American. There are Haitians here who have become a good Americans, right? So on a case-by-case basis, the racist thing to say would be to say, well, they can't come in because they're Haitian. The rational, basic, national interest-oriented necessity is to say, if you look at a country and at scale, the country has the character that Haiti has, you don't want to import a significant portion of that population en masse to America. Because people will retort, well, you can screen them, et cetera, et cetera. At scale, you really can't, not with anything like the actual comprehensiveness and the necessity that we would need. So that's what I would say to that, is that it's okay to recognize basic distinctions at scale between different groups or national, places of national origin or whatever you want to call it. In our immigration policy, that's actually something we need to do. But that we should absolutely be open to letting in people on a case-by-case individuated basis if they can demonstrate, and you know, there are people from all across the world of all different colors that can demonstrate this, that they will be good for our country. But the immigration policy has to be oriented towards that priority. What is good for America?
The interesting thing is, I think that most Americans agree with you. This is an issue that is absolutely killing Biden. And most Americans are like, this has got to stop, right, left, and center. Even the majority on the left, you know, you've got the few. I'm kind of amused at the people in the Northeast who are like, you know, these, you know, little white liberal couple who are inviting people into their home from, you know, fill in the blank country, which is just absurd to me that this is even a thing. I feel like it's the redcoats being put up in, you know, my barn or something. No, you know, but outside of those people, most Americans are like, this has got to stop. And it's an interesting, I don't know how the left is going to argue this in the next election, because it's such an overwhelming issue at this point.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, Republicans got taken for a ride pretty recently, because what they're going to do, and this is our own goal on behalf of Republicans, is say Biden tried to solve the border crisis because he had this bipartisan border bill, and Republicans are obstructionists who didn't actually want to do anything about it. Now, those of us who actually pay attention know that that's nonsense. A, the Biden border bill was awful. It wasn't going to do anything. In fact, it was probably going to make the problem worse. And B, you know, it's if Biden wanted to solve the border crisis, he could right now.
Right now,
we need legislation to do it. Right. So it was obviously a political stunt on behalf of Biden, because he was going to win either way. If they pass the bill, he said, look, I'm doing something about the border crisis. If they don't pass the bill, he can try to transfer blame to Republicans for the border crisis. The question is, are Americans going to fall for it? And I think, you know, it's an open question. I'd like to think that they won't. But, you know, it's up to Republicans to a certain extent to make it clear to Americans that, you know, the catastrophe of what's happening at the border and what's been happening at the border is fully on the hands of the Biden administration and his allies in Congress.
Yeah, well, you know what? This was Mitch McConnell's big FU to the Republican Party, just like John McCain completely did the same thing with Obamacare when he had the chance. Mitch McConnell, this whole, you know, Chuck Schumer talking in, you know, hagiographic terms about his great colleague, Mitch McConnell. If you're getting praise by Chuck Schumer, who single-handedly nearly destroyed the country and the world with the banking crisis in 2008, and moving up to that, if you're getting praise, you're not helping the country, you're not helping your own party, you're not helping anything. And Mitch McConnell, on his way out, poisoned the well on this issue. And Scott and I talked about this previously, about why he did that. So I can't lay this all at Biden's feet, but the fact is that under Biden, and he could change any of this tomorrow, Mayorkas is on record, and I hope they play his interview on repeat, where he just so proudly says, we've undone every single one of Trump's reforms. Well, good for you. Look at what you've done. And hopefully Americans get that message. We'll see. Republicans are very, very good at snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory. And so I have no faith whatsoever in anyone in leadership to do the politically astute thing. I just have no faith, born of lots of experience. So I encourage all of you who are watching to go read Nate's first piece as an employee at the American Spectator over there. It's a really incisive and demonstrates why we hired him. And so I'm so glad to have you here today, Nate, and thank you for stepping in for Scott. And soon you'll be having your own podcast here. And so over time, as Nate gets integrated into the system, we chew up these people and spit out something awesome. No, he's already awesome. But as you get integrated into it and doing it more, you'll be able to see Scott back here and Nate on his own in his own podcast and on ours too, probably. And with a newsletter and everything else. And you'll have to subscribe to be a part of all of that. So please subscribe and please follow Nate. Nate, where can people follow you on Twitter again?
On Twitter again, I'm at NJ Hockman, HOCHMAN. So follow me there.
NJ Hockman. And yes, he's always constantly stirring up trouble over there. So he's a fun follow. which is good. There's no better place to stir up trouble. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Like and subscribe. Subscribe to the American Spectator at spectator.org. If you want to donate and help our young writers program, you can do spectator.org/donate. And then subscribe at the various channels, wherever you're listening to us, whether it be on Spotify or iTunes or on X or Rumble. And when we get unbanned here soon, hopefully, of course, we have conversations like this. We get rebanned on YouTube and YouTube too. So thanks for joining me today, Nate. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Melissa.